On this week's 51%, an author takes a look at religious nationalism.
So one thing that Christian nationalists have been incredibly successful at doing is in controlling the narrative of the past. They've sold us this idea that their movement was a grassroots reaction to abortion.
A rapper talks about her music and experience.
The more women we can get out there, the better.
And the VA wants to build more trust among female veterans when it comes to health care. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Oh, there must be something in the water. And now I'm singing along to Amazing Grace. Can nobody wipe this smile off my face? Got joy in my heart. Angels on my side. Thank God. Author and New York Times contributor Catherine Stewart was disturbed by the religious right, which she believes has masqueraded as a social movement preoccupied with cultural issues such as abortion and same-sex marriage. In her latest book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, Stewart's on-the-ground reporting reveals the movement's political motives and its ultimate goal of power by showcasing the inner workings and leading personalities. She spoke with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill about why she began her investigation more than a decade ago.
I first got interested in the topic in 2009 when a Good News Club came to my daughter's public elementary school in Santa Barbara, California. Good News Clubs are designed to convert very little children in their earliest years of learning into a deeply fundamentalist form of evangelical Christianity. And I was astonished to learn that there were thousands of these clubs operating in public schools nationwide, rather than in churches or in homes or even in public parks or all the number of places that we're all free to practice our religion, if any. So they were targeting children in their public schools at the elementary age with the message that they would go to hell without Jesus. And in our community, I saw how these clubs in public schools confused little kids into thinking that their school supported and endorsed the form of religion that was taught by the club. And the adult leaders that were leading the clubs used their position inside the schools to recruit kids, to get kids to recruit other kids, and to get kids to proselytize their kids, other kids and their classmates. At the Good News Clubs I attended, kids were offered candy or prizes for recruiting their peers to the club. So I thought these clubs were really wildly inappropriate in a diverse public school environment. But I also thought, at first at least, that they were kind of a relic of the American past. It turns out I was really wrong about that. And the more I learned about these clubs and the movement they represented, the more concerned I became. I was stunned by the movement's legal sophistication, its determination, its coherence, and the sort of high level of strategic thinking that had allowed these clubs to operate in public school settings. So I published a book about the topic in 2012, and over the years I kept writing and digging deeper. I discovered that these Good News Clubs were just one small part of a larger attack on public education, and the attack on public ed was just one part of a larger attack on America as a modern constitutional democracy.
In your years of doing the research, what are the statistics on race, ethnicity within the Christian movement?
That's a really interesting question. I think the relationship between the movement and race is complex. Many people characterize it as a white movement. And I think for some of the people in the rank and file, it is implicitly a white movement rather than explicitly. For them, it involves recovering the idea of a nation that was once supposedly Christian and white. So it ties, it's a form of identity politics, really, in that it ties the idea of America and the idea of the true American to specific religious and cultural identities. But leaders of the movement can see the demographic future as clearly as you or I can, and they realize that if their movement is to have a future, it can't remain all white as America is becoming more racially diverse. So in recent years, they've made a really concerted effort to draw in some number of Black and Latino pastors and other leaders in hopes at least of capturing the votes of some subsection of their congregations. I think also some of the leaders of the movement have made an effort to involve themselves in racial reconciliation efforts. But there's irony here, okay? You know, this isn't letting them off the hook. They tend to paper over the way in which hyper-conservative religion and racism tend to reinforce one another, right? They enforce this idea that there's a sort of world of the pure and the impure, the insider and the outsider. And they also are, you know, engaging these people of color in the culture wars that drive support for a political party that has made race-based gerrymandering and voter suppression a strategic imperative.
What about female versus male?
Oh, that's also another really interesting question. I mean, the movement is unabashedly patriarchal. Many of the leaders of the movement, not all of them, because the movement is sort of theologically diverse, but many of the leaders of the movement, they promote this idea of male headship at home and at church. If you dig into the documents about the sort of theological beliefs of many of them, they advocate a kind of idea of sort of hierarchy. Hierarchy is justified in the Bible, as one leader said. It's might not be what I want, but it's what God wants. They sort of pass the buck there. But, you know, issues around sexuality are being used clearly and channeled for political purposes, and that's what conservative movements around the world do. And they do this around not just gender hierarchy, but also sexuality. I mean, look at some of these homophobic policies in Russia. Religious nationalist movements always draw on sexual anxieties, and they actually actively cultivate them. I mean, the say transgender bathroom issue is really a case in point. It's a marginal issue. It's not something that defines most people's lives, most straight people's lives for sure. It's, you know, more important to trans people, but it's not coming from the grassroots. But conservative leaders have turned it into a defining issue. And their concern here really doesn't have anything to do with bathrooms or prevention of sexual harassment, which, you know, is rampant in our society, but doesn't largely take place in women's bathrooms in public buildings. But, you know, if they were concerned about sexual assault of girls, for instance, at school, they would focus on sexism. But they do this in order to, you know, focus on these issues in order to provoke a certain set of anxieties that can channel votes to their side. It's really a way of riling up the base.
You draw an important distinction between leaders versus followers in the Christian movement. Can you explain that to our listeners?
You know, I think the rank and file may believe sincerely that they are voting for things like a ban on abortion or defense of what they call the traditional family. But over time, leaders of the movement have cultivated these issues in order to capture the votes of this cohort and direct power to the hyper-conservative hyper-conservative political candidates that the movement favors. They know very well that, you know, if you can get people to vote on one or two issues, they can control their vote. So, you know, when leaders of the movement are talking to the rank and file, or when they're talking to pastors about the issues that they should communicate to their congregations to turn out the vote, it's all abortion all the time. It's always like, we need to save the babies. But we have to, you know, look at the history of the anti-abortion movement to understand how this was cultivated as a political issue over time. When they're talking to their political allies, and when they're talking to certainly to the plutocratic funders of the movement, they're advocating a much wider range of policy positions. A lot of it is about economic policy, about how the government favors low taxation or no taxation, about how the Bible favors low taxation or no taxation, how the Bible favors minimal regulation for business, minimal regulation for the environment. They're really advocating economic policies that will, you know, enrich the profit margins of their plutocratic funders. Any student of power knows that the first step in controlling the present is controlling the past. And so one thing that Christian nationalists have been incredibly successful at doing is in controlling the narrative of the past. They've sold us this idea that their movement was a grassroots reaction to abortion. So there's a fascinating episode where leaders of what would become the religious right got together and went down a laundry list, basically, of the issues that they thought might unite their new movement. This happened around 1980 or so, about 7 years after Roe v. Wade was passed. And abortion was about number five on that list. Number one was what they called the unfair tax treatment of racist academies. They viewed that the idea that the IRS might remove tax privileges from, you know, tax exemptions from segregation academies was, they thought this was just terrible. But they knew that that wasn't an issue that was going to really unite their movement. So the women's rights movement was another issue that they were concerned about, but the ERA at the time was kind of going down in flames. There were several other issues on the list. They crossed out one after another, and they came to abortion, and they said, wow, that could work. So we have to remember that, you know, most conservative-leaning American voters have been persuaded over time that abortion is the single most important issue when it comes to their vote. But we need to understand that over time piece of it. When Roe v. Wade was passed, the Southern Baptist Convention hailed the decision as a sensible middle ground. Most American Protestants at the time supported liberalization of abortion law. Barry Goldwater, that great conservative hero, supported abortion law liberalization at least early in his career, and his wife Peggy was a co-founder of Planned Parenthood in Arizona. I mean, can you imagine a Republican politician today whose wife is doing that type of thing? But over time, pro-choice voices were purged from the Republican Party. So the pro-life religion that we see today is a modern creation, and it was created for political purposes.
How is this different than liberals being in power and pushing their agenda?
I think it's, you know, it's a really good question. I think that it's important to note that there's always been, you know, activism in on both sides. But the Christian nationalist movement is operating at the top of a large pyramid that's operating largely in the tax-exempt sphere. So, for instance, non-religious nonprofits like environmental organizations, I'm thinking about this, they have to open their books to the IRS. They have to show where the money is spent. And when organizations like the family, you know, some of the faith-based organizations are operating essentially as partisan political cells, certainly some of the right-wing churches, they are operating out of the public eye. I mean, look, I think some people try to show this as like a kind of conspiracy. It's not. This is a, you know, conspiracies are, you know, take place out of the public eye with unnamed actors. This movement is really, you know, operating in plain view. It's not that, you know, they're hiding. It's that progressives aren't listening. They're using the tools of democratic political culture to dismantle democracy. And I continue to believe those same tools can be used to restore it.
What type of on-the-ground reporting did you do for this book?
Over the years, the past 10 years, I've attended a number of right-wing strategy meetings and gatherings and marches for life, different conferences. I just went places that anybody's allowed to go. I spoke to numerous members of the movement, to continue to communicate with some of them, many of the leaders, as well as many of the followers. Definitely did a lot of reading in this area, spoke to leading researchers. You know, this is a book is a deep dive into the inner workings and leading personalities of this movement that has turned religion into a tool for political power.
And during this time, where did you find that the funding originated for the Christian nationalist movement?
The funding question is a really good one. The movement derives its funding from multiple sources. First of all, it derives much of its funding from a collection of sort of plutocratic funders, many of them belonging to these hyper-wealthy extended families. I'm thinking of, you know, the DeVos Prince families, the Green family, the Wilkes brothers, fracking billionaires, so many others. The movement, much of the movement's daily activity also involves obtaining small-dollar donations from the rank and file. I get mail every week, for sure, from the Family Research Council and some of these other organizations that are always asking for donations. And finally, I think the movement is asking in some ways for, well, they've already received substantial tax subsidies and exemptions, and those are quite lucrative, but I think they are trying to substantially increase the flow of public funds in their direction. through grants and vouchers and other types of schemes. So this is obvious, particularly in the field of public education, where religiously motivated voucher advocates argue that the public funding of religious schools is a so-called religious liberty issue. They already receive some number of tax dollars through vouchers, but they want to expand that flow of funds. And it, you know, goes even farther. At present, 8 different federal agencies are rewriting the rules of how they obtain public money for their initiatives and offering, you know, in ways that will allow them to engage in discriminatory practices and in some cases even to proselytize to whom they're delivering those services.
We are in a election year, 2020, presidential elections coming up. You talk about the so-called values vote in 2016 and how important it was for Trump to get elected then. Are these voters still behind him today with everything that's happened?
I can't generalize about every single voter who voted for Trump in 2016, but the movement is behind Trump for sure. Movement leaders are. They defend him. He's at the events that he holds, he's always standing up. He and his and people like Mike Pence are all standing up and saying to movement leaders and to the rank and file, I think I've given you everything you want. In fact, I think I've given you more. And a lot of the folks who voted for Trump were trained by their leaders to vote not on the issue of personality, but on the issue of judges. I remember one movement leader at an event stood up in advance of 2016, and he said, this election is all about judges, judges, judges. And then he led a prayer that Lord Jesus would be King of America once again. So the movement, to be clear, is anti-democratic in that it promotes the idea that our foundation of our country is not the Constitution, but the Bible. But they're also training the rank and file to put in the judges that will obtain the changes that they want. To date, Trump has appointed 192 federal judges. That's over 22% of the federal judiciary. And, you know, if he wins another 4 years, think about how much of the federal judiciary he can put his stamp on. It's really quite astonishing.
That was author and New York Times contributor Catherine Stewart speaking about her latest book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. She was speaking with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill. The book is published by Bloomsbury. Last year, 20,000 women transitioned out of the military. Yet compared to men, they're much less likely to get their medical care through the Department of Veterans Affairs. So the agency has stepped up its efforts to convince female veterans to give VA health care a chance. Jennifer Brookland reports for the American Homefront Project.
To understand who the VA was set up to serve, look no further than the agency's motto, to care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan. When that motto was adopted by the VA in 1959, women were capped at 2% of the enlisted force. Women veterans have historically, even officially, been an afterthought. So women like Tanisha Tumblin, a Marine stationed at Camp Lejeune, have repaid the favor.
When I think of the VA, I see wounded warriors and I see broken people and someone without a limb. Women's clinic never crossed my mind.
Tumblin is separating from the military this summer after 6 years in the Corps. And like many other servicewomen, she assumed VA healthcare would feel the same as the medical attention she received on active duty. That is to say, not exactly attuned to a woman's needs.
When it comes to medical treatment for women, they automatically assume, oh, she's just saying she's hurting so that she can get out of this field op or this hike. And that's not the case at all. And another thing, they assume that we're all pregnant.
When she began her separation process, Tumblin never considered enrolling to get her health care through the VA. That's part of a long-standing trend, one the VA is hoping to reverse with the Women's Health Transition Training Program. Nancy Marr is the program's senior manager. She says female veterans wait longer than men do to enroll in VA healthcare, and at just 25% are under-enrolled in general.
They think that the VA is only for men. They don't think that VA is a quality place to get care, and they're just very unaware of all the healthcare services that the VA has for women.
Marr sees that under-enrollment as a big problem for women, whose health needs could fall through the cracks as they transition out of the military. The VA says women face greater health-related challenges after military service compared to their male counterparts, including chronic pain, depression, and suicide. So to persuade women to enroll in VA healthcare, the program holds interactive seminars for troops who are about to leave the service.
Welcome again to the Women's Health Transition Training. We're so happy you've taken time out of your busy day to join us.
Kelly Griffiths is a trainer with the program, addressing online participants from Lackland Air Force Base.
We're in the military for a long time. We have our needs taken care of. But just know, as you transition out, the VA can be there for you, as you can see, for a whole host of reasons.
Griffiths says the seminars are totally different from most military training. They're led by female veterans like her who use VA healthcare themselves. And Griffiths says just having a training geared toward women makes a difference.
They're so happy when they leave because there wasn't anything in the military that was ever women specific.
Mar says it's working. Women who've taken the training are more likely to enroll in VA healthcare and to do so more quickly. At Fort Hood, Texas, Larry Rocha is retiring from the Army. She says the training made her see the VA differently.
We sit back and we listen to, you know, the horror stories about receiving medical care at the VA, and knowing that we have the option as women to seek all of our health care from the VA when it comes to women's health was a huge relief to me.
Rocha says she plans on enrolling, and Tumblin says the training gave her a change of heart, too.
I definitely need to recognize that the VA is not at all like Marine Corps medical, and that they really are out there to help. And there are programs geared towards women. So no, I don't have that mindset about the VA anymore.
As her time in the Marine Corps comes to an end, she'll be signing up for healthcare at her local VA. I'm Jennifer Brooklyn reporting.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Next, we meet a rapper who says there are not enough women in the genre. KFAI's Dixie Trichel produced this audio portrait.
We gaze when it's a new return. Forcing an argument, feeling the burn. Owning the privilege to take it back. No sweat for the name. It's instead of catch. Watch your time. Own your dimes. Because the rhymes don't through the mind.
Hip hop is one of my first loves and memories as a child, growing up in a rural area and just needing an outlet.
Oftentimes I smile like a wee first bit. Take my life back through the looking glass. In with time, my wicked nerves will pass. 8++, hop on the school bus. Education on us. What do we
ask without Diane Miller. I also go by D Mills. And I'm a rapper, singer, songwriter, and I'm also the talent buyer for Ice House, which is a music venue in Minneapolis. I grew up as a biracial kid amongst mostly white community in Fargo, North Dakota. My mom was born and raised in the Philippines. Being queer, a person of color, someone who grew up with not a lot of privileges, but was really talented and was really good at music, I found a way to be heard and be seen.
Try your luck. Don't ever give your tall truck yourself up. Bend it till it breaks. Rule out whatever's fake.
I write very stream of conscious. A lot of my writing, I'll just beatbox the rhythm and write a bass line over the beatbox and then see if I can come up with a cool, like, melodic phrase over the top. What gets ignored? I wanted to put something out that had accessibility to it, a positivity. Also, this is real, and this comes actually from a place of grief and loneliness and sadness, but it can be approached in a positive tone.
Snap the fingers and move forward alive on things that were once died on and now are sourced to thrive on, inspire on like an icon.
For me as a vocalist, when I rap over that da 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 da, you'll hear the same kind of trippy rhythmic phrasing I use in my rapping. I'm fluid in choice to try on what I can't afford to buy on, but at least I can let bygones. It follows the cadence and the flow of the groove over the drum beat bass line. I wanted it to have a little bit of unpredictability rhythmically. It has a strong downbeat and then it has a weird, like, kind of trip over itself, hesitation that before it goes back into the downbeat. And It's also just minimalistic. It's the same two chords throughout the whole song. That's definitely a characteristic of hip-hop, is a repeating theme to basically get out of the way of the vocalist.
First off, put up a fight, let a girl be right, because it's right and worth it. Though ever so far from perfect, I'm choosing a birth and nurture it, not bleed if it's...
You just really, as a female rapper, have to endure, because there's just not a lot of you out there. I mean, I've had experience of being in Minneapolis, basically being bullied on stage. And I was on stage next to this other rapper, and they basically put their arm out in front of me when I started rapping. And oh my gosh, did that ever cause me some like rage and anger. And then I kind of took it out just back freestyling, and it felt really good. But yeah, that was one of the most blatant displays I've ever felt of like the struggle of being a woman and being a rapper and being respected. The more women we can get out there, the better.
That's why I seek purpose, an unfound calling, and lady rapping. I'm odd looking, so I must be happening. But don't deny say me, I care when you play.
You don't have to be a fast rapper to be considered good. The speed and the diction in rapping, it can be very difficult. Diction is such an important element, having people understand what you're saying. But also the tone of your voice, the quality of your voice, does it sound good? What's so beautiful about rap music is that it intertwines the rhythmic flow of lyrics with a beat.
Quitting for the new fantastic, I have it now, babe, but better than the day before. Go get it, ever, never said ever, the weather ever, let it get a better, make ahead of me. No, never, ever, never, for a bigger. Got horse for another level, roll for the never heavy, go better. Here we go, no stop, drop, get it back, with a drop, stop. This why I'm hot, this why I'm not. This is what I got to make it to the top. Put it set, go on spot.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1617.